So we are on Daf Yud Alef Amud Bet, towards the top, right at the top, second line down. We just finished off this second statement of Ullah in the name of Rabbi Eliezer, or Rabbi Elazar. He'd said one linked to our Gemara earlier. Then we sort of jumped from that to talking about fetuses and again something totally different. And again, now for something totally different, Omar Ula, Rabbi Elazar. We're now going to jump to a totally different discussion. So here, Yud Alef Amud Bet is right here, right back at the beginning. So if we go, yeah, 11.
I don't have to unfold it, it's a slightly longer script.
Oh, there you go. So we are as I said, Omar Ula Omar Rabbi Elazar, Bechor Shenitraf. So this is a firstborn. We're talking about human beings now, because last time we were talking about animals as well. This is just talking about human beings. We're talking about, of course, the mitzvah in the Torah to redeem a firstborn, which is why we've brought a Cohen along. Well, maybe we'll do a bit of show and tell as we if anyone's a firstborn here and missed their opportunity, now's your chance. So there's of course a mitzvah that you have to redeem the firstborn, and we'll talk a bit more about the background of that in just a moment. But the Gemara clarifies over here that the opinion of Ullah is that if unfortunately a child is killed, Basoch Shloshim, right? Shenitraf means literally, you know, sort of torn away. It's talking about an unexpected death, you know, God forbid. You can imagine, hopefully it doesn't happen nowadays, but once upon a time, you know, with an animal or something like that, a wild animal. But even nowadays, you know, some sort of act of violence within 30 days. Then, Ein Podin Osa, then there is no requirement to do Pidyon HaBen. Why would you have thought there was a requirement? So again, we'll discuss that in just a moment. The Chain Tani, and so we have taught. We have a Braisa along these lines. Rami Bar Chama, or a Mishnah really, along these lines. Rami Bar Chama says, Mitoch Shenemar, since it says, Podo Tifteh, because the verse says, you should surely redeem, Yochel Afilu Nitraf. We might have thought that that refers to the fact that, you know, in a sense, your obligation starts right from the beginning, and even though the child has now been taken away, the child is no longer alive, that in a sense, the redemption should still take place, right? That you should still be required to do that. Pesach Shloshim, Afilu Nitraf Pesach Shloshim, even if the child is killed within those 30 days. Talmud Lomar, but the verse has an extra word. Ach has the word ach. It doesn't just say podo tifteh, it says ach podo tifteh. So this verse is in Bamidbar Yudchet, chapter 18, Tesvav. That's the second time where we talk about redeeming a firstborn. So we'll pause for a bit of background in just a moment. So ach, cholak. So ach, basically this word ach means but. Ach always comes whenever we have that word in the Torah. The Torah Shebaal Peh teaches us that it's there to sort of limit the mitzvah, or limit the commandment that is happening in that time. So the commandment over there is podotif there, you should redeem. And the limitation is the fact that even though you might have thought that in a sense that requirement begins at birth, even if the child doesn't make it till 30 days, so the answer is that no. Ach means that you do not need to do the redemption if the child is no longer alive at the end of 30 days. Okay, God forbid. You do not need the child to be present in order to redeem it, but you do need to. Okay, so let's do a bit of background. Okay, so a bit of background. So the first one is that why do we wait 30 days to do a pidyon haben? This is an easy one. If you had to take a guess, why would you say that we have to wait 30 days? Because that's what the Torah says, right? So I mean, when it's phrased, it says, all right, so let's just, it's not over here, it's actually in the verse that we don't have written over here. It says in Parashat Beshalach, unless I'm mistaken, or Parashat Bo, right, the beginning, right, the first commandment for, see if I have the first written over here, I think it's in Parashat Bo, right, towards the beginning of Shemos, after the death of the firstborn, that's where we're first commanded to redeem the firstborn, and there it says on the 30th day, right, on the 30th day, that's when you, Miben Chodesh Vamala, right, from the 30th day and onwards, when they are 1 month old, that's when you redeem the firstborn. So Tosas clarifies, that's why we don't need a verse to tell us that if God forbid a child dies naturally within 30 days, then that's clarified within the Torah. But in a sense, one could have, you know, made this suggestion without this limitation that if it was an unnatural death, then in a sense, you know, this child should have been should have had a pidyon ben, and there was therefore an unnatural occurrence which occurred within those 30 days, which should make you required to do that pidyon, to do that redemption, even after the 30 days. And therefore we have this limitation. The word ach tells us, gives us the limitation. So what was Andy, what was your question again? Your question was about...
You need
the child to be present, yeah. So the answer is, no, you don't need the child to be present. The mitzvah falls upon the representative of the child, so that's naturally the parents. But it is actually important to know that it doesn't happen massively often, but if let's say, a person didn't have a pidyon haben, and the person grows up to be an adult, so you should do it yourself. Okay, that's, in a sense, the mitzvah still remains, even into adulthood, right? And you should do that yourself. Now that you're able to do it for yourself, they do say, I don't know if it's true, they do say that the Vilna Gaon would regularly redeem himself because he wanted to make sure, because again, there's always a question on priests nowadays as to, you know, you're never really sure of the lineage, you know, and all of that. So he wants to make sure, so he sort of, anyone he finds who was who he thought might be, you know, might be a real authentic priest, he would again do another redemption.
The body is present, then you're doing it yourself or for someone who may not have been redeemed.
What suggests? The fact that it's redeemed?
It suggests that the body, that the individual is physically present.
What suggests that, though?
Yeah. Well, the example you just given, about him continuing redeeming,
yes,
means that there's something to redeem. If there is a child who has died, has been mauled or whatever we're going to say now, then
no, but the representative is still there. Meaning, as I said,
but what are you redeeming? This is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. So that's the question. So let's. I mean, we're not going to go into an in-depth discussion of pidyon haben, but classically, or the way I had the pidyon, actually, Aaron is fifth generation pidyon haben. So we're currently trying very hard to keep him away from any girls who are the daughters of Cohen or Levi, so that he doesn't sort of get any ideas about marrying them. You know, we can try and keep our traditions. I mean, the other boys are fine, but as I said, in the fifth generation, we try and keep that up. I had a rabbi in yeshiva who was seventh generation, and then he had a daughter, and his oldest daughter grew up knowing, you know, that she sort of broke the line of of being there. Yeah. So,
and you're absolutely right, because the ceremony itself says this in redemption for that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just go back to the core of the thing. So you're right. You do it when you go through it. There's this whole give and take, and actually talk about. There's always the joke of, you know, oh, you know, what if you don't do it? Then in a sense, you could have ended up belonging to this fellow instead of to me, right? So the answer is, although we actually go through that whole thing, that's really just to give us a sense of the gift of a child, rather than any realistic. There is no scenario in which we say, actually, you know, we'd like you to go to the priest, as opposed to or let's say the parents don't have enough money. There's no. I mean, we have in history where a person gave, for instance, Shmuel. That's classic one example. Shmuel was given by his mother to serve in the temple, but that was when he was 2 years old. Later on, and that was a sort of a very unusual, strange situation. That wasn't to do with pidyon haben per se. The idea of pidyon haben, I always grew up thinking, was to do with the fact that the firstborns lost their right to serve in the temple, right? And that's why they need to have that. So that's true to an extent, but it's actually difficult the big difficulty with that is that the mitzvah of pidyon haben predates the Egel HaZahav, predates the golden calf. The sin of the firstborn was at the golden calf, whereas the first time we have a record of pidyon haben in the Torah is, as I said, is after the death of the firstborn, just before the Jewish people leave Egypt, right? Then that is the point at which we're given the mitzvah of pidyon haben. So it seems to stem from that, from the fact that, in a sense, God took the firstborn of the Egyptian, of the Egyptians, but left the firstborns, the firstborn of the Jewish people.
The reason why yes. The Vilna Gaon would do it repeatedly is because he wasn't sure of the lineage of the Kohen.
Right, exactly, no, correct. Yes, okay. Not sure of his own. Yeah, exactly. No, I don't think he did a bracha each time. No, I would imagine he didn't. I can't imagine he did a bracha each time. There are people even nowadays who try to specifically find what is called a Kohen Meyuchas. So there are certain priests who have within their family a clearer family tree that goes right back. So I mean, we didn't use one. I used a friend of mine who was a Kohen who doesn't have any specific, I don't know, family tree that goes back to.
The ones, these three of me, and then I was only interested to do, I had the Cohen gene. So in 1998,
yes.
I was a study at Hebrew University.
Right.
40%. 40%. So they can't say it's exactly the right time. There's another group who have and there are 20% who have the gene, the genetic sequence.
Right.
And I was in the second group. So I did the fatal thing, went on Google just to look. Oh, I'm in the second group. I got the result, actually. I was standing next to Ray Greed on the train. So you better look at this. But the theory about the second group, so the 20%, the theory, I don't know who the rabbi was, but I was reading it. Part of Josephus, the Roman, the Jewish war,
right.
Because the Koenig were trying to exercise political power at the time, just in the last few centuries of the,
right.
the temple, so people were buying their way in.
Yes.
So the theory was that if you were the 20%,
yes, then you're part of that group.
Who tried to buy their way in.
Fascinating.
I could possibly, very possibly make a friendship.
I'm not, yeah.
Yes, it's so. I'll
people are not massively convinced by a lot of these. I mean, those genetic things. I mean, it's nice stuff, but it doesn't really. I don't think, in halachic sense, it doesn't have a massive.
No, it's not.
It's also, again, don't forget, we're talking about here patrilineal descent. So in a sense, genetics should work both ways, unless I'm mistaken. I mean, I don't know how they do it.
So
they do it based on chromosomes or what?
Yeah.
So it's great. Yeah, I don't know.
And
so they can do it with Y chromosomes, and they can know.
I'm not a scientist at all.
I don't know either.
Presumably, there's tradition in the family.
Yeah, it is. Correct. But it's different, as I said, that is what we call a Kohane Chazaka, what I'm known as Kohane Chazaka, which is based on tradition in the family, versus Kohen Meyuchos, which has a sort of a clearer tradition. There's not a massive difference between the two. Like I said, in practical terms, we basically follow whoever says they are a Kohen, or whoever seems to be legitimately claiming to be a Kohen nowadays will do so. And a very interesting one I found, I mean, this has nothing to do with Pidyon HaBen, but I've noticed an interesting one recently, people who have a tradition, I think it's like come up in the last century or so, people who have a tradition that they are a Kohen but they don't duchen, which is like a funny one. Good night, sir. I'm going to get you when it's time to go to bed, but you need to go to sleep now. Come on, light it off. No, you don't want to sleep here. Okay, good night, see you in the morning. So yes, indeed, that was our redeemed child. Yes, indeed. May not marry the daughter of a Kohen or a Levi. So, yeah. Indeed. So, as I was saying, yes, so as I said, it predates this, the sin of the golden calf, and I think I don't actually remember who it is. I have a feeling it's Tosfot. When he talks about redeeming, what exactly are you redeeming them from? Right? So what are you redeeming them from? So one of the commentaries refers to it as redeeming them la'avodat chol, which literally means for secular work, right? Which seems strange that you'd make a party for that. You know, it's like we're celebrating the fact that, in a sense, they can now, I don't know, well, maybe that's it. You know, they can now work as an accountant, as opposed to having to work in the temple or anything like that. So that's not the idea. So Ryakov Kamenetsky, I think, has a lovely piece where he talks about the fact that this is sort of one of the fundamental ideas of Judaism, that what we're celebrating over here is the recognition that although priests are designated to work in the temple, we don't consider working outside of the temple to be any less of part of the service of God, in a sense, right? Being part of the regular workforce is considered in Judaism as just as significant, right? If you sort of take it in that way, if you make it as part of your lifestyle, you know, and that leads us to further, you know, religious fulfillment, etc., then that is as critical and as important and seen as something that is as significant as working in the temple. It's, in a sense, it's a division of roles rather than a hierarchy. So I always think that's a very nice idea. I spoke about that a little bit at Aaron's Pidyon HaBen. So that's a little bit of background, and again, there is this concept of it's difficult to apply this nowadays, but there is certainly a concept of what's called a nefel, which is a sad case, in a sense, a child who is not. Who never survives for 30 days for natural reasons, right? And as we said, that is according to many the reason why the Torah specified 30 days, right? Because 30 days is in a sense you know, why, I don't know, why does God put a soul into this world just for less than 30 days? We don't know. But in a sense, 30 days is considered to be something which is fixed, right? Like when you have a home and you put a mezuzah on it, 30 days is always the time which makes something something which is a fixture in this world. So as I said, you know, a soul that comes down for more than 30 days considered to be a fixture in this world. And that's why the Pidyon HaBen takes place from that point. I always remember, I mean, thank God with technology nowadays, the world has changed. I always remember my best friend's oldest child had a blockage, and again it was a relatively minor, they referred to it as a minor procedure, so he had a minor surgery and he was fine and he made it to his Pidyon HaBen. But it was one of those things that he said, you know, a century ago that was it, you know, he would have been 2 weeks old and finished. So thank God, you know, very privileged to obviously live in times where that's not not the case anymore.
The source is in Numbers 18, that's this one. Yeah,
but so as I said, so the mitzvah itself appears twice in the Torah,
okay.
Once in Parashat Va and once in we should get a chumash. Well, at the end we'll get a chumash and we'll find the proper source, or the other source, I should say. Okay, so that's one. Okay, so that's another one of Ullah's statements that as we said, the we have this this limitation of the word ach, which means that even if it's an unnatural, you know, God forbid, an unnatural death of the child within 30 days, then even that does not require a pidyon haben. The mitzvah is not required. Va'omar Ullah. So the next one, now about 7 or 8 lengths down from the end. Va'omar Ullah, Omar Rabbi Lazar, ha'achin shecholku. Oh no, sorry, I've skipped one, haven't I? Yes, va'omar. Oh, sorry, it was six lines down. Va'omar Ullah, Omar Rabbi Lazar, behema gasa niknes b'meshicha. I'm now talking about a larger animal. Let's say you want to acquire a larger animal. Yeah, not buying chickens now or gerbils or anything like that. Right, buy a big animal, you know, a cow or something like that. Then you want to buy that animal. How do you acquire that animal? What is the method of acquisition in halacha? So so we say it's bimeshicha. Meshicha means you sort of you cause it to move in a sense, right? Meshicha is sort of pulling it in a sense, right? You cause it to move, and the fact that you pull it, so that's enough. V'ha anantanan, didn't we teach b'mesira? Mesira means handing it over, right? So in a sense, it has to be handed over from the owner to, from the first owner to the second owner, from the previous owner to the current owner. B'mesirahu da'omar, so right, it was required. Sorry, so hu da'omar ki hai tana. So no, the opinion of Ullah in the name of Rabbi Lezer is according to a different opinion, i.e. the following one from the following brisa, D'tanya, as we have stated in a brisa, V'chachomim omim zu v'zu b'meshicha. They are of the opinion that that it is done b'meshicha. Rabbi Shimon omer zu v'zu b'hagba'a. Okay, so we have three different opinions as to how you acquire this large animal in halacha. You're now buying a large animal. What is the best way to do it? Some say it's with Masira, right? That's the opinion of Rabbi. That's the opinion of Ullah. Sorry, the opinion of Ullah is with Mashicha. Some say it's with Masira, right, where you actually hand it over from one owner to the next. And the other one is Bahagbah. So Hagbah is a great one, right? Hagbah means lift it up, right? So what does it mean? You lift it up, right? So you lift a cow. Forget lift a cow. Let's say you want to acquire an elephant, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So how do you do that? So the Gemara discusses that. The main sugya over here is in Kedushin. So the Gemara says you have to. The Gemara says you use. I can't remember. I think it's called Chavile Zemurat, right? Which is whatever. Basically, sort of like long sticks of something. So what exactly does that mean? So one says that it means chavilez. I think the one opinion is chavilez mar means you sort of build a structure in a sense, so that it raises itself. It sort of climbs up to this raised structure. You use the rods to build it. But the other one is you hold it above the animal. Animal jumps to get it, right? So you sort of hold the bamboo very high, and whatever. And the elephant sort of takes a leap to try and do it. Not the safest thing to do. And that's what yeah, I'm joking. I can't imagine the elephant jumping to do that. But maybe even. Yeah. We're talking about large animals here. Behema gasa. This is talking about specific. Correct. Well, I don't know exactly what you would where you would draw the line. But over here, for instance, my explanation here refers to as kagon shova chamor, so like an ox or a donkey. Right. So we're talking about larger than yes.
Is this in Baba Batra as well, isn't it?
Possibly. I mean, Baba Basra is full of acquisitions of stored. But the main sugya they refer you to over here is the one in Kiddushin. But where in Baba Basra it talks about? I don't know. It could be. In fact, here, you should often have a little note on the side. From over here, so let's see, this Gimel will go to... Oh yeah, it is in Baba Basra, there you go, 86b, excellent, very good, that's what we have. Okay, so Kedushin, very good, Kedushin 25b, and we also have a reference to Baba Basra 86b, so there you go, comes up a couple of different times, excellent. Lovely. Yeah, I mean, one is called a Behema Gasa and one is called a Behema Daka, and it does have different... There are a number of different, you know, ways in which they differ in halacha. One of the other classic ones is obviously in shechita, right? The type of shechita is slightly different. So again, classically between chickens and larger animals is different. And unless I'm mistaken, I don't think there is any shechita of a behema gas of a large animal in the UK. So I think all of our meat is imported from Ireland or Poland, unless I'm mistaken. All of our non-chicken meat. Chicken is done here, done locally, but I think all the actual meat is done, Ireland or Poland. But there you go.
And
maybe part of our... Yes.
The Middle East, did you have to shech this?
You
don't shech fish.
That's a good question. Yes, that's a mitzvah. Sorry, that's not a... trying to think. Do you have to shech chicken from a Torah? Yeah, go on, imagine. Yeah, I'm sure you do. Yeah, that's not...
So
that's
an
not
example of a non-meaty...
Correct, a non-meaty shechita. Maybe, presumably that's why it went that way, in a sense, because it is very similar in many ways. I'm sure that's a Torah mitzvah. I mean, now you've got me... Now I'm trying to actually remember something explicit on this front, but I'm sure it does require shechita from the Torah.
It's a different process, though, isn't it?
No, the shechita itself is pretty similar. I mean, practically, it's a little bit different.
Malika,
you can do Malika, but that was never the classic way to do it. that was the unusual way to do it, in a sense. That's sort of an exception to the rule, rather than the basic.
And they're in the midbar.
Yeah.
Oh, the quail come.
Yeah.
That's after Sisa,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. Well,
they
quail.
The quail.
Yeah, I think so. But the quail is
they
not.
Fell up.
Too many of them.
Yeah. People question whether it's actual
dead.
Quail or not, but who said they fell? Does it say
well,
they fell dead?
They fell dead.
I don't think it says they fell dead.
Well,
it's Michael Mitzvah said, I'm trying to remember now. I don't think it says
that.
It's in Valotra, yeah.
They fell dead from the sky.
Yeah, I don't think it says they fell dead.
Oh, okay. There's just lots of them.
Yeah, there were tons of them.
Ada Shariyat,
say me apachem. You have so many that it comes out of your nose. That's what the Torah says, yeah. How were they caught? There were just so many of them. What do you mean caught?
A quail can fly.
Is that kind of chicken? Well, a chicken can't really.
Not really.
No, but they're quite, I don't know, maybe they're quite docile. A lot of these birds are quite docile. I mean, the chickens are very very easy to go with. I don't know.
Okay.
We didn't, they dropped all these requirements. But these are not things that rabbis get asked about nowadays. Once upon a time, you used to bring your chickens to the rabbi. Indeed, yes. You know the one about the lady who used to bring her chickens to the rabbi every year.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the other one you have.
Oh no, not that one. No, the one with the lady. The lady brings the chicken to the rabbi and she says, you know, is this chicken? She brings them the sort of, you know, the dream. Is this chicken kosher? Yes, it's kosher. Yeah, it looks fine. Anyway, so she brings the next week. Yes, this chicken kosher? Yes, this chicken's kosher. Anyway, so she comes back the third week and she says, you know, rabbi, she says, it's great. I keep coming to you. She said, the rabbi down the road says I can't get the chickens from Tesco. She said, but you know, when I bring them to you, you always tell me that they're fine. So, yeah. There you go. All right. So that's about the. So that's again the second part, the second statement of Ullah in the name of Rabbi Leza that we're going to, or Rabbi Leza that we're going to deal with tonight. It's about larger animals acquiring larger animals. Now we move on to the third one, about nine lines down. Ve'omar Ullah. Nice, again, potentially controversial, not actual controversial, but you know, hopefully, whenever we talk about division of assets and things like that, unfortunately, and inheritance, you know, people sometimes can become a bit of a difficult topic for people. But so this is talking about, you know, hopefully a standard, regular inheritance, everything is going fine, all the siblings are getting on and everyone's happy, and they're all dividing up the assets. So, ha'achin she'chalku, Masha alehen shomin, masha al bnehem ubnoisehem ein shomin. So if they happen to be wearing clothes that were from their parents, right? Whatever they're wearing, you know, they have coats or whatever, or they're wearing their father's old suit or whatever it is, then that is included within the estate, right? Within the I went to the valuation of the estate before you actually divide it up. Masha al b'nei sehen, but what whatever their children are wearing, their sons or their daughters are wearing, then that's not included within the division of the estate. So interesting, you know, where exactly this comes from and why that should be the case. So let's just finish this piece of Gemara and then we'll sort of discuss it more in detail. Omer of Papa, Rav Papa says pa'omim af masha alehin ein shamin. But Rav Papa clarifies that actually even sometimes what they themselves are wearing, i.e. this is now the children, that the children of the deceased, what they're wearing is not included within the, i.e. they get it themselves and they don't need to sort of divide up the value of this with all of their siblings. Ein shamin, why? Mashgachas la begodol Ache denicha lehu, right? We're talking about, for instance, if you're talking about, let's say you have the oldest sibling, denicha lehu, where everybody's happy for them to have this fancy suit. You know, they take their father's fancy suit. Why? Delish de ma'un mile. Because, you know, they're the one who's going to represent the family, right? They're the one who's, let's say, you know, they're taking over the family business, and they're the ones who are going to be representing the family in court or whatever it may be. So they want them to have the fancy suit, so everybody agrees that they'll sort of get that thing. So the truth is that although this is a statement of Ullah, you know, that he sort of sets this out as a standard, you can see from my sense from all the commentaries is this is very sort of based on what's accepted and what's normal in a sense. And you know, they're talking about, so why, for instance, does Ullah begin by saying that what the children are wearing but the grandchildren is not included, what the grandchildren are wearing doesn't count but what the children are wearing does count? So he says, so actually, I think Rashi clarifies it quite nicely. So Rashi says, "Masha al b'nehen." So he said, "Dekiven de bonim v'bonos." This is now, let's say, about 2/3, yeah, nearly halfway down, the omud. The first word on the line is b'nehen. If anybody sees, sometimes in bold. First one on the line is b'nehen. Yeah, it's around where your finger is, Anthony, but I don't know exactly. I can't see from here, so it should be around there. First word on the line is b'nehen. I think it's a little higher than that.
Yeah.
I think a little higher than that. Higher than that, I would say. Yeah.
Closer to there.
Oh.
There you go. That's it. Yeah, that's the one. So there you go. Masha al b'nehen ubonosein ein shamin. De kevon de bonim ubonos lo osu le beidina. Because you're not bringing the grandchildren to court. Lo mavzinon lehu lemisik. Right, we're not going to, you know, mavaza means to disgrace. I mean, it's quite a strong term, but it's basically saying, you know, you don't need to sort of make it difficult for the grandchildren that you have to sort of schlep in all these grandchildren. Now they're the ones who are wearing the clothes, so you don't need to bring them all into this discussion in Bet Din now that they're figuring out the exact worth of all of the property. And actually, so again, the commentaries also clarify, interestingly, that this applies to sort of weekday clothes but not to Shabbat clothes, potentially for two reasons. Number one, you could say that they're potentially more expensive, right? We're talking about things which, you know, your regular clothes, okay, so, you know, you've got a coat or whatever, it's not so much. So in a sense, there's sort of a general acceptance among the siblings that, you know, little bits here and there that are not included in the valuation are going to be okay. And more than that, Shabbat clothes you don't need to schlep the person in because they're not wearing the Shabbat clothes, so you can just bring the clothes without the person in them, right? So whereas we're talking about when they're wearing the weekday clothes, so they're wearing them, so they're, you know, so they're using them, so they don't need to bring. Again, this is talking about a time where you didn't have lots and lots and lots of different clothes, where you could literally just bring the clothes. So I'm not convinced that we would do this nowadays, in the sense nowadays probably would be everything in the sense that would be included. But the other interesting thing from here is you know what, I'll say another interesting thing about about the oldest brother afterwards.
Apart from the idea, obviously, respect for the Beth Din.
Yeah. No, not for respect for the Beth Din, we're talking about respect for the children. That you don't want to drag the children, that you don't want to schlep the grandchildren.
Why would you pay for the Beth Din to establish the value of the estate or something? Okay, very nice to be dressed nicely.
No, you don't have to be dressed nicely. Oh, you're talking about why the oldest sibling. No, forget the Bet Din. Let's say they're now... like I said, we're talking about before you have multiple items of clothing. I'm talking about presumably once upon a time where this was your weekday garment was your weekday garment for the next however many years that you're going to wear it, right? So this sibling, actually, so now you've mentioned that, so let's clarify. So again, the commentaries also clarify that this doesn't literally, although the Gemara refers to it as Ach HaGadol, doesn't mean it has to be the oldest sibling. It means the one who, you know, sometimes you have the sibling who you know is the one who is sort of leading the family in a sense, or taking on the I was talking to someone recently who's a child of six, and they said that when their mother died a long time ago, when their father died, they said it was siblings five and six who ran the show. Siblings, they were the ones who sort of, you know, everyone did whatever they said. So they would be the one, in that case, they would be the ones, as I said, they're the ones who are taking, we're talking about, the sense you get is the one who is taking over the family business, you know, who's in a sense representing the family in all sorts of spheres of life, and so therefore everybody, maybe we could translate it into not clothes over here, let's say it would be the car, right? Like maybe, you know, the parent had a particularly nice car, right? So, you know, so in a sense, where all the siblings agree to the fact, or there's a sort of an implicit assumption that because if they're the ones who are going to be taking over the family business, that they'll also get the the father's car as well when they sort of do that, to sort of be able to carry on that legacy and that sort of thing.
The presumption is that this is after the death.
Exactly, you know, correct.
Because if it was before the death, then it would have been.
Exactly, correct. Yeah, so all of this has been taken on. In a sense, after the death, exactly. Yeah, it sounds like there's a sort of a gap between the death and this valuation, which presumably is normal as well. You know, where, yeah, exactly, where it doesn't happen the very next day. It sort of takes time to actually get on with this, and things have moved on since then. In a sense, the car has already started to be used. Whether or not you should do that is an interesting question. But what you're getting the sense over here is that where there's an implicit assumption that you can actually sort of do that, right? Where there would be an implicit assumption that you. So I think it would be based on. As I said, but sounds very much to me from the commentaries like it would be based on time and place. You know, like it would change depending on where you are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So that's, as I said, that's the next statement of Ullah. And actually, I meant to say, this is an interesting link between what we talked about before, the Bechor. I think I've mentioned this in the past, but I'm always fascinated by the concept of the oldest, you know, and being the Bechor, like I said, because of Bechor, and maybe that's why, I don't know. But it seems to me quite clear from the Torah that although there is a concept of a Bechor and of an oldest child, that that it's really nothing, or not nothing to do with being the oldest, but it's almost very little to do with being the oldest. If you look through the quote-unquote Bechor from the Torah, almost none of them are actually the oldest, right? You go, in fact, literally I can almost not think of a single one who's the oldest. I mean, like, for instance, think of Avraham wasn't the oldest, Yitzchak wasn't the oldest, Yaakov wasn't the oldest. If you go through the 12 children, right, if you were to pick out any, you would pick out Levi, Yehuda, or Yosef, none of which were the oldest, right, in a sense, you know, depending on, I guess, your where you're going with that, right? Menashe and Ephraim, there's also the whole sort of switching of the hands and that sort of thing, with the oldest. Moshe wasn't the oldest, David HaMelech wasn't the oldest, you know, like, you literally sort of go through, Shlomo HaMelech also wasn't the oldest, King Solomon wasn't the oldest, so, like, you literally go through the whole, I'm always interested by that again, there is a concept of having a child who takes on the legacy of the parents, but it's very rarely, it seems to be much more linked to the one who it's fitting to do, rather than the technical.
And yet the oldest would get a double portion.
Yes, correct. Yeah, yeah, so yeah. Right. Yeah. It is an interesting one.
Not getting leadership.
Yeah. Although again, yeah, that's, yeah. You can.
It was the custom in those days. Yes. All sorts of stuff.
So that's a different one. That's a more difficult one because there's an explicit verse. In that case, there is an explicit verse. You have to deal with it.
They have the same
explicit verse. But we do have there is a concept of what's called a halachic will. I'm not an expert in these things, but there is a concept of a halachic will where you sort of divide up your assets in a permissible way. I think, you know, where you sort of I wouldn't say circumvent, but certainly try to ensure that all of your children get what you feel is you would like them to get. Rather than, yeah, exactly. I don't know exactly how it works, but there you go. Okay. So that's statement number three of, well, it's really statement number five because we had two last week as well. So now I think is the last one. We'll probably end up ending with this one. But Omar Ula Omar Rabbi Lazar. Now we're just under halfway down the Omud. He says as follows. I find this, again, a very fascinating case. Shomer shemosar leshomer. So now you have a custodian, right? Somebody who's looking after something, and they pass it on to somebody else to look after, right? You give me something to look after, and I say, and while I'm looking after it, I say, actually, you know, I'm a bit busy, I can't look after it right now, can you please take care of it? And something happens to it, right? So what's the halakha? So Ula says, potter, right? They're exempt, right? If I am guarding something and I give it to someone else, then I would be exempt from any from whatever happens to that. So what does that mean? Anything. So let's come back to what that means in just a moment. But he clarifies, velomi boi, this doesn't need to be said for shomer chinam shemosar leshomer socher. So where I am an unpaid guardian and I'm passing over to a paid guardian, because in that case, in a sense, the level of watching seems to be going up, right? The level of liability seems to be going up. So you're saying that in that case, it's even for sure, you know, that's almost like obvious that you would be exempt in that case. But even, he says, even in a case where in a sense the level is aliyei lishmiroso, the level of guarding is going up. Ela afilu shomer sachar shemosar leshomer chinam, where you have I'm paid by someone to look after something, and I give it over to someone who is unpaid to look after it. The hashda grui gar ilishmiroso, and in a sense we're lowering the level of guarding, nami potter, even in that case you would be exempt. Why? Shahari mosar leben das, because you gave it over to, you know, to a regular person. You gave it over to someone who legitimately should have been looking after it. That's a fair thing to do. That's the opinion of Ula. We're going to have an opinion that disagrees in just a moment. But just to clarify, when we're talking about potter, according to almost everybody, I think there is a unique opinion otherwise, but everybody argues on this. There is a quoted opinion otherwise, but everybody argues and clarifies that when we say exempt, we mean exempt from what you would have been exempt for anyway. It doesn't mean you're off the hook totally. It means so, for instance, a shomer socher. Let's say I'm a paid guardian, right? So I would be exempt from theft, right? Let's say the item was stolen, I would be exempt from that, right? Assuming I did my job. But let's say I was negligent, then I would be liable. So in that case, you would still be liable if your appointed guardian was negligent and it was stolen, then you would be liable still, right? Because it was lost through negligence or this happened through negligence, you would still be liable. So the point is, potter in this case, exempt, means your level of exemption remains the same, right? You're exempt for what you would have been exempt for otherwise. That's the opinion of the law. Even that, you know, you could disagree on, so much so that the next opinion of the Gemara does disagree, right? So we've said that the opinion of Ullah is that you would be, you know, in a sense, you're retaining your exemption, but others don't agree. Rava Omar, so we're now probably just below halfway down, in the middle of the line. Rava Omar, Shomer Shemosel, Shomer Chayev, right? If you hand it over to someone else, then you're liable. Velomi Boi, and he clarifies again that we're talking about not just where it goes down, but even where it goes up. So again, Lomi Boi Shomer Socher Shemosel, Shomer Chinom, I'm being paid to look after this, and I pass it on to someone who is not being paid. De grui gor ilishmiroso, the level of guarding seems to be going down. Ela afilu shemechinem shemosel shemesachar, even where it goes up, where in a sense I'm being unpaid, I'm not being paid, and I've now paid someone to look after this out of my own pocket. You know, in a sense, you should say that's going up, right? They're going to do an even better job potentially, and even still, I will be liable, not just for what I was liable anyway, but liable for everything. I will be liable no matter what happens to this. To Omar Le, why? Because, so this is an interesting one. So the Gemara over here gives the reasoning for Rava as being, at mehemently bishavua, because when you exempt yourself as a guardian, let's say legitimately exempt yourself, you know, let's say it's stolen, right? So it's stolen and I would be exempt. You have to swear in order to be exempt, right? You have to swear that you did what you could have done and it wasn't your fault. And once you make that oath, then that's enough and then you're exempt. But he says, I'll believe, in a sense, the original owner is saying, I'm happy to accept your oath on this, but I don't know who this guy is. So this guy's swearing that he did enough before it was stolen. I don't know who this guy is, right? I want the oath to come from you, and you can't make the oath because you didn't watch it. So in a sense, because you can't make the oath, that's why you're liable. Hi, lo mehemen li b'shavua. That guy, I'm not going to believe his oath, right? So, interestingly, I think Tosus actually over here might be somewhere. Oh, it might be Tosus elsewhere. But I think Yeah, the tosis over here, over here. So it's the third tosis from the bottom. It says lafi ta'am zeh. So it's just the third. Should it begins with the word at. Begins with the word at. Towards the beginning of the line, the third one from the bottom. At Mehemet Levishvua, Lafita Amze, according to this opinion, Im Hasheni Ne'emon Yosemin Arishan. If you have a particularly believable second guardian, right, this guy's considered to be a very, very trustworthy fellow, Nira de Potter, right, it seems to be that according to Rava, you would be exempt. Right? However, he does clarify, I'm not going to read the rest inside, but he does clarify that actually in the Gemara elsewhere, later on, where's our mafkid? I think that's here. Mafkid Behema Okalim. Yeah, that, I think it's in Baba Kama. Might be in Baba Matzia, actually. But anyway, so the Gemara over there... Yeah, it's in Baba Matzia, sorry. So the Gemara elsewhere in Baba Matzia says that... gives a different reason for this. They say it's not just about the oath. Me, I'm happy for you to take the oath as opposed to this one. What it means is... In a sense, I think the phrase that the Gemara uses, "Ein rutzoni sheyehei pikdoni biyad acher." My will, my desire is not to have this item being guarded by someone else. When I gave you my Ferrari, I gave it to you because I trusted you, right? The fact that you've given it to someone else, I don't care if you think they're more trustworthy or whatever. I didn't give it to them, right? In a sense, and that's why you're liable. So there seems to be a difference of the reasoning, and potentially would be a difference of the of the outcome as a result of that. But as we see over here, so Ulo is of the opinion that you're going to be exempt, that your level of exemption is going to remain the same, whereas according to Rava, your level of obligation is going to go up if you give it to someone else. As we clarified from Tosis, potentially with this difference of whether the fellow would be trustworthy or not, right? So interesting.
Would it be different if the first
bailee
had come back to the owner and said, "I'm going to
yes.
go to somebody else"? To
yeah, them. Yeah, because then yeah, I think definitely would, because that would have been with their then they have then again they have no claim in that yeah. in that regard. Yeah, I think that would be a very significant. A very significant difference. And again, interestingly, so we're talking about over here. So there was another interesting one that I also sort of noted. Where was this? So here's the following thing. I was puzzling over this. So let's say according to Ulla, so you'd be exempt. So I am now a Shomer Chinam, and I've been asked to look after this unpaid, right? So let's say a Ferrari, whatever it is. We're talking about something big, let's say something very expensive. So you've given me your Ferrari to look after unpaid, and I pay someone to look after it, right? And it gets stolen, and it gets stolen. I think you'd still be liable as a Shomer Chinam. So that's not a good example. But let's say it was struck by lightning. Yeah, whatever it is. Or someone else drove into it. Okay, someone else. Well, that's also different because then they'd have to pay. But let's say, it's struck by lightning, for example. Okay, it's struck by lightning and disaster. Okay, so now, in this case, so who has to... Oh, no, that's also not a good... Oh, sorry. I've got it the wrong way around. I am a paid guardian and I give it over to Shomer Chinam. So again, Ulla says you're exempt. So I'm being paid to look after this and I give it to someone to unpaid. Now it's stolen. Okay, it gets stolen by someone. So I'm not liable because I'm a paid guardian. Paid guardian's not liable for theft. But they are an unpaid guardian. I gave it over to an unpaid guardian, so they are liable for theft. So they have to pay. So who are they paying? So maybe they pay me, right? So they pay me because I asked them to look after this Ferrari. Now I don't have to give the money over to the original owner. So now it's worked out very well for me, right? Because I've done. So that's what I was thinking. I think that's madness. So actually, the Rishonim, I can't remember where I saw this actually. The Rishonim clarified that is madness. that doesn't work. That you can't come up with this system. Here, where is it? You can't come up with a system. I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's something along the lines of basically you can't use someone else's thing to become rich. So you can't say that I'm making money off your loss, right? That doesn't work in this case, right? So in a sense, if they are paying back, then the money's either going to go back to you or no one's going to pay in a sense, right? I don't know which one it would be, but it doesn't work to sort of say you're paying back to me and therefore I'm not liable at all. There are other cases in which that quirk might happen where you sort of make an acquisition. In it, but there's more. Yeah, there's more involvement. See on
it's
that.
It's a strange situation, isn't it?
Yeah.
If I give Phil my Ferrari to look
after, yeah,
and he asked David to do it.
Right.
And I don't give it down. As you said before, who David is, I don't know.
Yeah.
David. my contract with you now, if you want to disperse it, your liability should still be to me.
That's the opinion of Rava. So Ulla's disagreeing. Ulla's saying that, you know, the reasoning he says over here is Shahari Mosar Lebendas. You've given it over to someone trustworthy. In a sense, there's no difference. Yeah, once you're giving it over to someone trustworthy, so, you know, giving it over means giving it over. The fact that I trusted someone to do it. I mean, listen, this is all in a case where as with all these sorts of things, if you have contracts, then it's going to be based on the contract. It's not going to be based on this, right? And if you have a standard law of the land, then it's going to be based on a standard law of the land. But this debate is, you know, in where all else is equal, what exactly would you do? And as I said, yeah, so it's debated. So Ulla's opinion is that if you're giving it over to someone sensible, then that's a fair thing to do. Yeah, that's a fair thing to do.
But according to here, the halacha goes with Rava.
There you go. So it's not a fair thing to do. So don't do it. unless you're willing to take on all the responsibility. Yeah. Because you're gonna be liable anyway. Yeah, that's what it looks like. Okay, very good. That's true. I'll tell you a little quirk how you know where the halacha is. If you turn back to the Gemara, you'll see how you know where the halacha is, even if you don't look up the thing. So they have, there's a little letter, the bold letter always, next to, Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet Hei. So I think it's the Hei over here, next to Rava's opinion. So you can see Rava Omer Shomer Sachar. Yeah, so that goes to this to the thing on the top right, the Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah, which is the reference to the Shulchan Aruch or the Rambam in that case. So whenever you have the letter on that opinion, your best bet is that that's the opinion which the halacha follows, because that's the reference. The reference to the Shulchan Aruch is coming from Rava's opinion rather than from Ulla's opinion. But that's just a little, little quirk. If you look up at Ulla, there's no letter Hey there. Whereas next to Rava's opinion, you have the little letter, bold letter Hey, which takes you up to the bottom right. And if you follow the letter Hey, it goes to Mem Yud Yud is short for Maimon, right? Which is the Rambam. That's the source within the Rambam. And then further down, you have Tur, and further down in that you have Tet Vav Shin Ayin, which stands for Tur Shulchan Aruch, which is the reference within the Tur and the Shulchan Aruch. As I say, where the halacha is. Okay, I think we're going to leave it there. If that's because the next part, yeah. Otherwise, we get into a whole another interesting thing. There you go. Mm. Good.